This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The weekend's come for tossing out the year 2004, and also for discovering which teams are not too sore to fill out all the playoff spots beneath the happy few who'll play tomorrow and move on no matter what they do. For predictions concerning National Football League permutations, I'm joined now by Paul Attner, who writes about the NFL for the Sporting News. Hi, Paul.
Hey, good to be back with you, Bill.
Now, listen, a lot of these games tomorrow just don't matter for the teams that are playing them. The Patriots, the Steelers, a couple other teams, they have the home field advantage. They have the bye week. It doesn't matter whether they lose or not. What is to prevent teams in that situation from simply trotting out the second string and sitting down everybody who matters so they don't get hurt?
Well, nothing. And that's part of the flaw of a system that's not fixable. There's nothing anybody can do about the fact that teams need to take care of themselves down the road for the playoffs. And it hurts other teams and it hurts teams trying to get in the playoffs. But ultimately, I think coaches' responsibilities have to be with their own players and in their own future.
Let's talk a little bit about which mediocre teams will rise up to fill out the NFC playoff bracket. You want to take some guesses on that?
Can I give you the whole list of NFC teams? They're all mediocre. So, I mean, it's hard to differentiate between any of these, you know, even the poor Eagles now that they don't have Terrell Owens. Probably the most intriguing game is the New Orleans-Carolina game because neither team for most of the season has played anywhere close to a playoff caliber level. And now, you know, they're going in this game fairly even. And Carolina's a great story because they start off one win in their first eight games, and no one in NFL history has ever come back from that type of start and made the playoffs. And I think that's going to happen on Sunday, that they are going to make the playoffs because they are going to beat the Saints. But, you know, if the Saints make it, their owner just a few weeks ago called them a high school team. So this will be
first high school team in the playoffs.
First high school team in the playoffs. So either way, Bill, we have history in the making here for this game, and that's why it's worth watching. It will be a pretty good game. I mean, like I said, Carolina's going to win, but it'll be a good game.
You mentioned the Philadelphia Eagles. At one point, they seemed an absolute certainty to get deep into the playoffs, if not to the Super Bowl. But Terrell Owens, the notorious and talented wide receiver, could miss the whole playoffs with an ankle injury. Does this ruin the Eagles' season, or is the NFC so bad it doesn't even matter?
Well, first I'll go on record, because you know how I like to go on record on this program, that Owens will not make play in the Super Bowl. I mean, he's, you know, it's wishful thinking by anybody in the Eagles to think he'll be back. But no, it does not ruin it. The NFC is so, seriously, so mediocre, and that the Eagles, even without Owens, are still, in my opinion, the best team in the conference. The margin that they had over Bale certainly has been diminished, and they have some of the same warts they've had in the past without him, particularly the fact that their other receivers don't seem to be very productive in important games, but they still have enough talent and experience. And McNabb, their quarterback, Devin McNabb, he is good enough, you know, to get them finally into a Super Bowl after three straight losses in the conference championship game.
One team that probably wishes it played in the NFC is the Buffalo Bills. They had a horrible start, 0-4, but they are arguably playing better than anybody in the league right now, and they could miss the AFC playoffs. Maybe we should send them to the NFC just to make it fair.
Well, I called the NFL office a couple of weeks ago and asked them if they could at least cancel the NFC playoffs and you know, make it easier for the rest of us, and they refused to do that. So maybe I need to call them back and ask them, you know, that alternative suggestion. At least do us a favor and put the Bills in there, because I think that's a reasonable offer, Bill. I really do. I think that the Bills are probably right now better than any NFC team. And the irony is they're playing the Steelers in the final game, and a lot of ex-Steelers are in the Buffalo organization, including the general manager and the head coach. So this game has a very deep meaning for a lot of people in Buffalo. And I think they're going to win that game. And then when they do, it'll be up to some other results, whether they get it or not. But for the AFC teams, I don't think any of them want to play Buffalo right now. So they're probably all hoping that the Bills lose and they don't have to face them in the playoffs.
Indianapolis Colts quarterback Peyton Manning wrested the single-season record for touchdown passes from boyhood idol Dan Marino this season. Could this be the year he accomplishes what Marino never did accomplish by actually winning a championship?
You got to say that real fast to see if you can do that, huh? You know, if funny. I was in Indianapolis earlier this week asking Peyton Manning the exact same question, because I think that is the penultimate question overseeing all these playoffs. Can Peyton Manning do it this year after all these wondrous statistics and the domination of that offense? I don't think he can, and I'm saying that because I think that their defense is still so mediocre. It may be a little bit better than last year, but it's still not saying much. That it's just not good enough to help them on a day, let's say, that Manning and the offense are not quite as productive. And that may happen in the playoffs. I mean, they could wind up playing New England in the second round, in a snowstorm. You know, at that point, the Indianapolis defense is going to have to play better than I think it's capable, and therefore I don't think it's good enough for the Colts to win it all.
Paul, the stage certainly seems to be set for a rematch between the New England Patriots and the Pittsburgh Steelers in the AFC Championship game, but maybe not. Is there a team out there that can prevent that matchup?
Well, I mean, certainly the Colts seem to be the most likely candidate, but I'll tell you something. San Diego came in to Indianapolis the next to last weekend of the season and should have won the game. The Colts wound up tying it at the last minute and then winning it in overtime, but the Chargers are kind of slipping on the radar. They've become a very competitive team, and they're going to be very difficult in the playoffs to beat, but ultimately I would think that matchup's going to take place, and if it does, I think that it's going to be in Pittsburgh for sure, and I think Pittsburgh at this point is a better team than New England.
Paul Attner covers the National Football League for the Sporting News, and he's our gridiron gabber from time to time as well. Paul, thanks very much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Bill. Thank you.
Tomorrow may turn out to be more of an off day than a game day for the Pittsburgh Steelers as they play out the regular season in Buffalo against the Bills. At 14-1, the Steelers own the NFL's best record, and they've already clinched a first-round bye and home field advantage in the AFC playoffs. The Steelers posted an unseemly 6-10 record last year. Ron Schachter reports on Pittsburgh's impressive turnaround.
During the offseason, the Steelers lured free agent running back Deuce Staley from the Philadelphia Eagles and drafted Ben Roethlisberger as their quarterback of the future. Those investments have already paid off. Despite pulling a hamstring 2 months ago, Staley has rushed for more than 800 yards. Roethlisberger, meanwhile, has won all 13 games he started, an NFL record for rookie quarterbacks.
They thought this guy would need a little bit more time to be ready. And he's proven to be the guy who has needed no time to be ready.
The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's Jerry Dulac has covered the Steelers since 1988.
He has great poise, he has great management of the game, and he doesn't make mistakes.
The 6-foot-5-inch Roethlisberger has completed almost two-thirds of his passes for 17 touchdowns. 2 weeks ago, he led a fourth-quarter drive to defeat the New York Giants and their rookie quarterback Eli Manning, who was chosen above Roethlisberger in this year's college draft. Along the way, Big Ben has won high praise from teammates such as wide receiver Hines Ward.
He's a great student of the game. He's learned so much, you know, week in and week out. He's picking up coverages better. You know, he's understanding what defenses are trying to do, you know, take away some of his strengths. So, you know, it's just great just to watch his development grow from the beginning of the year now towards the end of the year. For us as veterans, we're just, you know, rallying behind him and try to do whatever it takes to win ball games.
It hasn't hurt that the Steelers have a host of offensive weapons, Ward and fellow wide receiver Plaxico Burress among them. With the help of all-pro linebackers James Farrior and Joey Porter, they also lead the league in overall defense. Dulac points to a list of team strengths that have helped Roethlisberger be so successful so early.
The offensive line, the ability to run the ball and possess the ball, not asking him to do too much, him not having to throw the ball. They're able to control the clock. It keeps their defense off the field, and their defense has played so well that they've held other teams in check. So that has allowed the Steelers and allowed Roethlisberger to not play from behind and to ask him to do things that, you know, might be uncomfortable for a rookie.
Looking rather comfortable these days is longtime running star Jerome Bettis, who took a $2.5 million pay cut and started the year as a second stringer before Staley got hurt. The 32-year-old Bettis has responded by gaining nearly 1,000 yards and scoring 13 touchdowns. Against Baltimore last week, Bettis passed Hall of Famer Eric Dickerson for fourth place on the career rushing list.
It's what I do. I mean, it's what I've been doing my whole career. So the one question was with my age, you know, I think that's making it more significant. But early in the season, I didn't get a lot of runs, so I think it really helped me for this stretch run because now I'm healthy, I feel really good. and I'm able to really contribute at a time that the team really needs me.
A 15th win tomorrow against Buffalo would set Pittsburgh's single-season team record. But the postseason and the real prospect of the Steelers' first Super Bowl trophy in a quarter century have moved to the front burner. The first-round bye gives injured stars Staley and Roethlisberger, who bruised his ribs in the Baltimore game, two more weeks to heal. And the Steelers head towards possible postseason confrontations with the New England Patriots and Philadelphia Eagles, teams they clobbered in the regular season, although Bettis cautions against reading too much into those victories.
It kind of helps you because you know the personnel and you played against them before, so you get an idea of what they want to do and what they're good at and what they're not good at. I don't know if it bodes well that you beat both teams, because usually when there is a rematch, the team that lost the first time usually wins the second time.
And should the Steelers advance to host the AFC Championship on January 23rd, they'll have to reckon with another unsettling trend. They've lost three out of the last four AFC title games they've played on their home turf. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Pittsburgh.
5 minutes on a check yard.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. During the run the Red Sox made to the World Series championship, Boston pitcher Pedro Martinez could often be seen in the company of Nelson De La Rosa, a Dominican man who is 28 inches tall. De La Rosa, who frequently visited the Red Sox clubhouse dressed in a Boston uniform and cap, was considered a good luck charm. But in his first news conference as a New York Met, Martinez dismissed De La Rosa as, quote, just a trick. He broke my heart, De La Rosa said, and that heartbreak may have major league consequences. De La Rosa recently said, I'm not going to the Mets unless some other Dominican ball player makes me an offer, and if the Yankees call me, I'll go with them.
Short people are just the same.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce rings in the new. But first, in the introduction to the 2004 edition of Best American Sports Writing, guest editor Richard Ben Kramer writes, I tend to like stories that treat a whole life, or at least make a connection between sports and the rest of life. That point of view in part explains why the current edition of this worthy series contains so much ambitious writing. Richard Ben Kramer joins me now from his home in Maryland. Richard, welcome to Only a Game.
I'm happy to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Also joining me from WVPR in Colchester, Vermont, is Best American Sports Writing Series editor Glenn Stout. Glenn, welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
And additionally, we're joined by one of the contributors to the anthology, Susan Orlean, who speaks to us from her home in Boston. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Susan, I want to begin with you. Your piece, which appeared originally in The New Yorker, is set in the exotic world of taxidermy competitions. Were you surprised when it was chosen for Best American Sports Writing?
Absolutely. I mean, taxidermy is one of these peculiar hybrids, I guess. It's a little bit of a sport. It's a little bit of an art. It's a little bit of a craft. It's a little bit of science. It's a little bit of a sort of post-hunting, and I guess hunting is a sport. So it combines so many peculiar subcultures, and actually given the spirit of the collection and the fact of Richard's interest in finding the ways that sports connect to our lives more generally, it made sense to me in that regard. And, of course, I was thrilled about it.
Richard, tell us a little bit about what appealed to you about the tale of taxidermy.
You know, there's a wonderful match in the piece, if you will, between Susan's very sharp observation of the life of taxidermy, the life of dead animals, if you will.
That's a great phrase.
And the way she can make words jump up and dance on the page, it's a beautiful match. I don't know who to credit with the assignment, whether Susan dreamed this up herself or whether somebody sent her there, but but it's a great meeting between artist and subject. So,
well, I have to tell you, it was quite funny because when I went into my editor, I'd become a little obsessed with taxidermy just for...
You obsessed?
Yeah,
I don't know how
strange.
That could happen.
I had seen a taxidermy catalog, and I had no idea that it was such a large industry, large enough to support many catalogs. I went into my editor at The New Yorker, and I said I'd really love to go to the World Taxidermy Championship. And there was a long silence, and he said, I don't think anyone else is covering that for us.
Well, now, Susan, are you encouraged by the presence of the taxidermy story in the collection to venture further into the world of sports? Should we look for you at the Super Bowl?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I have to tell you, to be perfectly honest, The one and only time the New Yorker ever covered the Super Bowl, I did it.
There you go.
And it was the second time, as far as I know, in the history of the New Yorker that they covered football. The other was the Harvard-Yale game in, like, 1922. So we don't have a lot of football coverage in the magazine. I love writing about sports. It's partly why sports writing has such a marvelous history and attracts so many writers. It's such a rich subject and so has so many built-in dramas and emotion, and it's so much fun to describe. And it's extremely alluring. It seems like you could certainly find a million life dramas within the world of sports and never run out of them.
Well, your story is one of three from The New Yorker that made the Best American Sports Writing this time around, Susan, and Roger Angel isn't even in it this time. Any worry that the magazine is becoming a sports rag?
I think it is becoming a sports rag. I think we just have to admit it and just stop pretending otherwise. Actually, you know, I have to say our editor-in-chief, David Remnick, put in a lot of time as a sports writer.
Absolutely.
So he has a great appreciation for it, though the one wonderful advantage we have is we only have to write about sports when we want to rather than... We don't have to be the paper of record on sports, but it allows that kind of freedom to find those stories that are really compelling and that get one of the writers excited, and that's what makes it so much fun to do.
Glenn, was Richard upfront about this, stories that treat a whole life business from the beginning? And if so, did that influence you in the choice of which stories to send his way?
No, he slipped it in under the door. you know, I just select, you know, the things that I want to read again and leave it up to the guest editor to winnow those down and parse those out the way he or she sees fit. And that's always, you know, seemed to work pretty well. And that's the way I think it worked this time. That's what's interesting to me in my role, is that despite the fact that I'm sort of doing the same thing every year, because we have a different guest editor every year, the book takes on, you know, a slightly different nuance each time. It's like it's being looked at sports from a different angle with every guest editor. And I think that keeps it lively and keeps it different.
Yeah, and this is a nice addition because it doesn't have the feeling of, here's a collection of stories by my friends.
Right. I think that's something that, well, one, none of us want to be beholden to our friends that much.
And in my case, it's not a problem. I don't have it.
Right. So you're the perfect editor.
I was going to say, it depends how many friends you've got.
Right. A lot of the stories in this edition of Best American Sports Writing feature moments that really made me stop reading because I realized that I had just encountered a really remarkable perception. For example, in a piece entitled The Leap of His Life, we get this phrase, "Every salaried second of official NBA action is pure anticlimax, a 48-minute celebration of the blessed fact that the drama of getting there is finally over." Richard, do you agree with me that this is the sort of observation that changes the way people look at pro basketball?
Well, I hope so. You know, I think that the great thing about putting a real working writer, a thinking writer onto sports, is that you can make new the dramas that are presented wall-to-wall on TV every day, mm-hmm. on, you know, in the newspapers every day. You know, if you don't think anew about these things from time to time, then you can't be the kind of fan I like to be, where you know, you're swept away from your real life to live for the moment in this drama on the court or the field or the racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the great writers make new for us the games that we have loved since we were kids.
Gary Smith's Sports Illustrated story about Mia Hamm, terrific story, marks about the umpteenth time Gary has been represented in Best American Sports Writing, Glenn. By now, does his stuff just automatically get passed on to the guest editor?
Well, not entirely, although, you know, as I go through everything, and particularly this is a time of year where I really start going through things, you know, intensely, it's almost inevitable that a Gary Smith piece that I've read earlier in the year, it jumps out and jumps onto the top of the pile and says, include me, include me, include me. So I'm a little bit sensitive to that, but we don't pick every Gary Smith story. So I think as long as we don't select every Gary Smith story and turn it into the Best American Sports Writing by Gary Smith, we're probably okay.
The Hamm story is positive, though Gary Smith maintains that Mia Hamm wishes that it hadn't been written because she doesn't like anything that draws attention to her. There are other very positive stories here, the one about former catcher and now Kansas City Royals manager Tony Peña's unlikely rise to the major leagues, for example. But there are some dark stories, too, such as the one about Michael Jordan's selfishness or Lisa Olson's tale of contemporary groupies. Glenn, were you trying to present a balance when you chose which stories to send along to Richard?
Well, I get a little concerned sometimes that I tend to be maybe drawn to stories that are a little darker, simply because I think the darker stories sometimes leave the writers a little more room to explore. So I'm a little sensitive to that, and I try not to overdo it. But again, you know, if the writer has the right chops, even if a story is dark, I think you can kind of come out of it a little bit transcendent. You feel a little fresher afterwards, even when you've been exposed to something that's very, very tough and very, very difficult. I even look at Susan's piece in that regard to a certain extent, because what are we talking about here? We're talking about dead animals.
Yeah, but beautiful dead animals.
Beautiful dead animals. And I love it because at the end of the day, when, you know, there's all these descriptions of deer and bison and everything, what wins the competition? Two sparrows building a nest.
Susan, I'm wondering, since you mentioned that you were thrilled that your story was chosen for inclusion in this collection, I wonder if you have a favorite among the others.
Well, I have to confess the two other New Yorker pieces in here I love, and I was thrilled to see them. I love these collections. I think it's almost like getting the Whitman sampler with all of the caramels.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like it's a great second chance, because if you're in the dentist's office and the hygienist says your turn before you get to Men's Journal or Bicycle Magazine, you get your second chance to read the good stuff here.
Right. And also, as Glenn was saying, I mean, one of the wonderful things is that each year it's got a slightly different feel. And I think that makes it so much fun to read, because not that it's so particularly slanted towards the guest editor, but there tends to be a kind of feel each year. I love these Best American collections for that, and it really, I love magazine pieces. I love this form of writing, and it may be partly that it's so well suited to one's pathetic attention span as opposed to a full-length book, but also it's almost like a survey of the year, the best writing and the most interesting stories and a lot of the ones that you've missed along the way. I mean, I don't read lots of sports publications, so for me it's a real pleasure because many of these are stories I've never seen before.
Richard, I wonder if the experience of being the guest editor of this collection has led you to any conclusions about the state of writing about sports these days.
Well, it's reassuring, I think. You know, when Glenn sends the big packet of, you know, all kind of stories that he's culled from everywhere and forever, it looks a little daunting, and you think, oh, my God, you know, how much sports do I want to read this month? But, you know, you very quickly find that the pieces themselves carry you away in the way that I like. It's encouraging, I think, and in the end, it's quite tough. I mean, you end up throwing out some really good stuff, and that's a great sign.
Richard Ben Kramer is the guest editor of the 2004 edition of Houghton Mifflin's Best American Sports Writing. He spoke to me from his home in Maryland. Richard, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be with you.
Glenn Stout is the series editor, and he joined me from Vermont Public Radio in Colchester, Vermont. Glenn, great fun as always.
Thanks a lot, Bill, and thank you, Richard.
And Susan Orlean wrote Lifelike, which is included in this year's collection. She joined me from her home in Boston. Susan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. Among the stories included on Only a Game 2 weeks ago was Ron Schachter's profile of Middlebury College in Vermont, an institution determined to emphasize excellence in athletics without compromising academic integrity. Among those not pleased was Mark Bites, a Williams alum living in Minneapolis.
I'm, you know, flabbergasted. You guys have got to be kidding, doing a story on excellence in Division III athletics without mentioning Williams College. I know it was a nice little spotlight for Middlebury, but I don't even send them a check as an alumnus every year, but I do follow the sports because it's something that we just crush everyone in, and it's just bizarre that you don't mention Williams College. Anyway, love your show. Bye-bye.
Mr. Bites has company. Robert Gowanter of Surrey, New Hampshire, wrote to point out that Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, has been to the D3 NCAA Finals in basketball in each of the last two seasons, and that the coach of the men's soccer team has compiled a winning percentage of 800 over the past 25 years. I hope this can be mentioned to give Williams College the recognition it is due, he wrote. Noah Igorin, who hears only a game via the Internet, found it, quote, interesting that Ron Schachter's story, quote, did not mention the numerous motions that the Middlebury president has put forward to de-emphasize sports in Division III. Also, he wrote, Middlebury is a very prestigious private academic school, and their success is in sports that tend to recruit from prestigious private high schools, lacrosse, field hockey, and ice hockey. Finally, the sports information director at Williams, Dick Quinn, emailed to point out that, quote, Middlebury has dropped four places in the U.S. News national academic rankings from 7th to 11th, and that Middlebury's average SATs of 1430 are quite impressive, but not up to the 1508 at Williams. Mr. Quinn suggested that we might also be interested in learning that the rosters of the Baltimore Ravens and Kansas City Wizards both include Williams grads, and that Williams is the home of the Frank DeFord Award. Several of those who called, wrote, or emailed in response to the story on Middlebury College wanted to know when Only a Game would feature a story about athletics and academics at Williams. Would such a story begin with the possibility that Williams backers, alums, and employees tend to be just a tad on the sensitive side? You decide. And when you've decided, or even if you haven't, write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. And you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
I'm Deborah Becker with these sports headlines. In yesterday's College Bowl action, Minnesota triumphed over Alabama 20-16 in the Music City Bowl. Miami foiled Florida 27-10 in the Peach Bowl. Arizona State beat Purdue 27-23 in the Sun Bowl. And in the Liberty Bowl, Louisville licked Boise State 44-40. Today it's Georgia and Wisconsin in the Outback Bowl. Tennessee faces Texas A&M in the Cotton Bowl. Florida State goes against West Virginia in the Gator. LSU will meet Iowa in the Capital One Bowl. Michigan faces Texas in the Rose Bowl. And the Fiesta Bowl pits Pittsburgh against Utah. For Only a Game, I'm Deborah Becker in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the pro football prospects for the little old ladies of Pasadena. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a look at the week's news. Happy New Year, Charlie.
Happy New Year, Bill.
Maria Sharapova, who won the singles title at Wimbledon last summer, will play a match in Thailand tomorrow, and she donated $10,000 to the relief effort in that country following Sunday's tsunami. Many people have been similarly moved, but is Sharapova the first well-known athlete who's rallied to that cause?
As far as I know, she is. Yeah, she was due to play an exhibition match against Venus Williams in Thailand, and apparently that prompted her generosity. And, one hates to play one-upsmanship, but it's time for Venus to step up a little bit here, I would say.
You have before you ESPN's list of top 20 sports stories of the year, Charlie. Are you comfortable with this list?
Well, some of them are bizarre. I had completely forgotten about Major League Baseball trying to put the Spider-Man 2 logos on first and second base during interleague games in June. That's the fourth leading story on this list. I'd forgotten about that completely, and what I remember is I wasn't that outraged by it. The fight between Indiana and Detroit is the top story of the year. I wonder if ESPN didn't have the NBA contract, whether or not the Red Sox and winning the World Series might not have bumped that out of the top spot. And as you know, folks around the office pointed out, there are only two stories on this entire list involving women, and neither one of them involves an athlete.
Absolutely. Somehow, Annika Sörenstam winning 10 out of the 20 tournaments in which she competed in 2004 failed to make the
list. Well, how about America's sweetheart Mariel Zagunas winning a gold medal? Where's that?
Like, or Mia Hamm, maybe the most influential female athlete since Billie Jean King
retiring
this year.
She has TV commercials. She's okay.
All right. On Wednesday, Washington, D.C., Mayor Anthony Williams signed legislation ensuring that the X-Expos will become the future nationals. He says the New Deal will keep the city moving forward. I think that's a quote, will it?
Yes, forward, 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 till it gets to the edge of the cliff, and then it goes right
over.
I mean, there's
right.
nothing to be said about this story except, sucker!
It's one born every minute, they say. Randy Johnson will become a Yankee, as will former Bronx Bomber Tino Martinez. Does this guarantee another trip to the Fall Classic for the Sons of Steinbrenner?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you've got a $66 million payroll for your pitching staff now, which is greater than the total payrolls of several of your competing competing professional baseball teams. I mean, I don't know. I think Mike Mussina, Randy Johnson, and Carl Pavano is a good 1-2-3. You know, you don't know if Kevin Brown's at the end of the road. Jarrett Wright's been injured. You know, and again, you don't know how the Yankees will play this out year after year after year. They still have to do something about center field. Carlos Beltran is still out there. Their everyday lineup is still good, not great.
This week, Major League Baseball sent a bill to the Yankees for $25 million. That was the luxury tax George Steinbrenner had to pay for wildly exceeding baseball's alleged payroll threshold last season. Can we look forward to a complete realignment of baseball powers as a result of that money being donated into the kitty?
No, I think this is what's commonly called around the Yankee headquarters boutonniere money, Bill. who knows what Shell Corporation and Cayman Islands tax shelter this check will be written on. I did like the fact they got it right down to the dollar, though, $25,026,352, which, by the way, is $22-odd million more than will be paid by your world champion Boston Red Sox. I just like to say that.
It's great fun, isn't it? Today offers us no fewer than 6 bowl games.
Hooray!
Any advice on which ones viewers will find most entertaining?
Yeah, at all costs, stay away from the Capital One Bowl. LSU is going to beat Iowa like it stole something. The intriguing game to me is number 5 Texas and number 12 Michigan in the Rose Bowl, if only to see Texas in the Rose Bowl, which doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. The other ones don't strike me, Georgia and Wisconsin and the Outback Bowl. The Fiesta Bowl is Pittsburgh and Utah. There's a little bit of interest there to see how Utah does. It would have been better if the Big East had been able to cough up a slightly better representative than Pittsburgh. But it is Utah's chance to play a relatively big-time program on national television, so we'll see about them.
Tuesday's BCS championship game, the Orange Bowl, is also known at least by Auburn fans as the alleged national championship bowl. I was shocked to read this week that there will be further tinkering with the bowl championship series. What new developments can we expect on that front?
Well, it's not so much tinkering so much as that they have to find another phony criteria to use because the Associated Press has told the BCS to stop using the AP college football poll as part of the determination who plays the national championship. The AP was rummaging around in the attic of headquarters and found its conscience in the steamer trunk that had left it a few years ago and suddenly determined that it was shocked to be part of this bungling system and didn't want to be part of it anymore.
Among the men's college basketball teams achieving upsets regularly enough so that we may soon have to stop calling them upsets is Gonzaga, although they lost on Thursday to Missouri. As you look at the rankings this week, do other obvious overachievers or underachievers leap out at you?
First of all, Gonzaga is everybody's favorite mascot every year until they lose in the second round of the tournament. They're a good team, but there are two things you can rely on come springtime. Number one, the best conferences will get even their mediocre teams in the tournament. And number two, Gonzaga will whine about where it's playing and what it's seeded and blah, 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 blah. It's a nice program. I'm tired of it by now, though. Having said that, the underachievement of the year is number 15-ranked North Carolina State getting absolutely drummed by a St. John's team that so far has lost to Niagara and Hofstra and St. Francis of New York and shooting an amazing 3-for-31 in the first half in the bargain.
And finally, Charlie, next summer in Missouri, it will be legal to grab catfish out of the water with your hands, should you be so inclined. Can I book a June flight for you to Columbia?
Woo-wee! Can we do it in the cement pond? Look, I know we blue staters are not supposed to look askance at the folks in the red state, but Missouri had to pass a law to legalize catfish choking? Woo-wee! That's living.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie, and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Bill. Happy New Year.
Years ago, Michigan beat Stanford 49-0 in the Rose Bowl to mark the first ever postseason college football game. Stanford was so thoroughly embarrassed that it refused to take the field for the final quarter. Texas hopes for a vastly different result when they meet Michigan in the 91st Rose Bowl today. Even though the Rose Bowl game is considered to be the granddaddy of them all, there are those who think the facility should be the NFL's rookie stadium. Only a game's Karen Given has this report.
It's early December, and Pasadena is enjoying one of those weekday afternoons for which Southern California is famous. The sun is shining, the birds chirping, the roses blooming, and the golfers, well, golfing at the Brookside Public Golf Course on the north end of the Rose Bowl.
The Rose Bowl is special for a million reasons.
Sue Mossman is the executive director of Pasadena Heritage, a private nonprofit organization which protects Pasadena's historic resources, including those in the Arroyo Seco, a picturesque dry river valley which boasts Pasadena's largest park, most lavish homes, and of course, the Rose Bowl.
Even in the days when they were considering building a college football stadium down here in the Arroyo, it was controversial, because people love this space as a park, and actually it had some other uses, including a hog farm and a bit of a city dump. So one thought was they would clean it up, they would make it a recreational facility, and the Rose Parade, which had already begun, would have a place to end, and people could spend the afternoon watching college football.
Convincing politicians of the day that the Arroyo Seco should be the site for the city's premier sporting facility was the task of architect Myron Hunt, who, the stories say, brought the mayor and city council to the Arroyo armed with a large board with a hole for the mayor's head.
So you can sort of picture it like a tabletop with the mayor's head sticking out of the top. And that was so that the mayor could see, if he wasn't looking at any of the rubble or the pig farm on the ground, how beautiful this site was, and if they had a major sporting facility here, what a stellar site it would be. But I can just picture these folks in their formal dress with a board stuck over their head envisioning the Rose Bowl.
By 1921, the Rose Bowl was built, though at first it was shaped more like a horseshoe than a bowl, built to accommodate the chariot races the city had planned in case college football turned out to be a fad. Mossman says, from the beginning, the facility's low profile was designed to fit in with the stark natural beauty of its surroundings. Today, the size and shape of the Rose Bowl is once again at issue because it's one of four sites being considered by the National Football League to host a pro team as soon as 2008. The NFL won't say whether it will expand or relocate a team from another city. The league is also not commenting on which of the four sites, Pasadena's Rose Bowl, LA's Coliseum, a landfill in Carson, or a lot next to Angel Stadium in Anaheim, the owners are likely to choose. But the NFL has made clear that if the Rose Bowl is to be chosen, it will need to have much, much more space.
On the exterior of the stadium, actually, we would need approximately a million more square feet of space to convert the Rose Bowl into an NFL stadium.
As a flock of birds descends on the peanut shells left behind from the annual grudge match between UCLA and USC, Rose Bowl General Manager Daryl Dunn lists the changes the 84-year-old structure would have to undergo to satisfy the needs of professional football. A second concourse, lounges, restaurants, additional locker rooms, and three to five times the current number of 45 luxury boxes. But the most important change would actually reduce the current number of 92,000 seats down to a more manageable 65,000, contrary to the needs of the Tournament of Roses, which has sold out every game since 1947.
It's an important issue because right now, even though it may not be as comfortable as we'd like it to be, if you lose 20,000 seats, you know, if you say hypothetically it's $100 a ticket, you know, that's a lot of money. But we think having more suites and having upgraded type of seats, you can end up charging more money for those suites. So economically, you actually may make more money with less seats.
While fans can expect ticket prices to go up, taxes are not. After years of failing to secure public funds for the project, the NFL now plans to pass on the $500 million price tag of renovating or building a stadium to the still-to-be-determined owner of the yet-to-be-determined team. But it's the number of zeros the league is offering to the renovation effort that attracted the attention of Daryl Dunn.
Frankly, we need something to try to stabilize our long-term future. Our stadium is 84 years old, and what it needs, really, it needs an influx of a lot of capital investment, and we think the NFL is a prime way to get that done.
Sue Mossman and the other opponents of the project agree the Rose Bowl needs help, but she questions whether the building's status as a National Historic Landmark can be maintained after the changes the NFL requires. And she points to the public golf course and surrounding park, which become the stadium's primary parking lot on game days, and wonders if the impact is worth it.
I think it's amazing that there's been no NFL team in Southern California for these many years. I'm sure this is a market that the NFL is very interested in being part of. And I'm also sure that some of the other sites they're looking at would work better for them, would allow them to build a stadium that really is successful as an NFL stadium, and might provide an economic boost in a place that needs one.
It's possible that the NFL is being so tight-lipped about which site is the front-runner because all of the sites have drawbacks. The Coliseum is farthest along in the planning process, but it's also a 90,000-seat stadium on the National Registry of Historic Places and has many of the same issues as the Rose Bowl. The site in Carson is atop a former toxic landfill, and developers won't have an environmental impact report ready until September, 4 months after the NFL had hoped to make a decision. And Commissioner Paul Tagliabue has expressed concern that the Anaheim site in Orange County is too far away from the L.A. market. Still, NFL Vice President Neil Glatt says the league remains committed to bringing a pro team to L.A. for the first time in 10 years.
It's always been an important market to us. Historically, we've had teams that have been successful in Los Angeles and have been well followed. It's a large market and a market that we'd like to serve for the existing fans and also for potential fans in the form of their having a home team.
But some of those fans actually cheered in 1995 when the Rams and Raiders left town. L.A. doesn't have much of a tolerance for losers, which the Rams and Raiders both turned out to be. And the inability of the Raiders to sell out the 90,000-seat Coliseum led to a television blackout of most of the team's home games. Now, with no home team, L.A. fans have grown accustomed to choosing from the entire NFL schedule via satellite TV. Still, Glatt says he's confident fans will be willing to leave their living rooms for the in-person experience of an NFL game.
I think we always thought there were enough fans. It's the second largest market in the country. It's a passionate fan base. They put 90,000 into the Coliseum or the Rose Bowl for USC and UCLA games. So it's a question of having the stadium amenities that fans are going to be willing to pay NFL ticket prices to attend a game and support the team. So I think once we improve the stadium, the fans will be happy to come and support a home team. So we're not planning on blackouts.
From his office, just blocks from the Staples Center, the home of the NBA's Lakers and Clippers, David Simon, president of the Los Angeles Sports Council, adds up the 27 million tickets to sporting events in the L.A. market sold in 2003 and suggests the city shouldn't have a problem selling a few more.
Take 70,000 seats. There are 8 games, home games in an NFL regular season. That's 560,000 seats. The Lakers, for 40 home games, sell 800,000 tickets. The Dodgers had attendance this year of 3.6 million. So selling that number of seats to an NFL game doesn't really sound that daunting in this market.
Well, then that sort of begs the question, do you need another sports entertainment option?
To me, that's like saying, do you need another restaurant in town? Arguably, you don't need another restaurant in your city, whatever city you're in. But if a good one opens, you know it'll be tough to get a reservation.
But others are not so quick to assume that another pro team in L.A. will be an automatic success. After all, what has L.A. missed in the 10 years since the NFL left town?
We've missed absolutely nothing.
Bill Plaschke is a sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times.
We've missed paying high prices and we've missed a few traffic jams, but we really haven't missed that much of anything. We have football here. We have college football here, and we can wake up in the morning and feel good about ourselves out here without football. We don't need football to think we're big league. We don't need football to think that L.A. matters. We don't need football to think that we're cool, because we already know we are.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Pasadena.
Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Sam Sanders at Vermont Public Radio in Colchester, Vermont. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or learn more about Best American Sports Writing 2004, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from writer and soon-to-be mom, Susan Orlean.
I'm serious. This is the sporting event of all time.
Coming to Fox Television this spring, Sports Writer Maternity Ward. Who can doubt it? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.